Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The Dakota Midday Book Club is rolling along. Today, we're featuring a conversation with author, poet, and professor Jim Reese. We've been reading his latest poetry collection this month. It's called Really Happy. Jim Reese is an associate professor of English at Mount Marty College in Yankton. Since 2008, Reese has been one of six artists in residence for the Arts Interagency Initiative with the Department of Justice's Federal Bureau of Prisons. I've known Jim for a few years. I have interviewed him several times. Fortunately, there are still things we haven't talked about. In fact, I started our conversation with a question, and it was a question Jim Reese didn't know how to answer. How do readers respond to Really Happy?
I have no idea.
Try not to ask them.
I think they like it, you know, as far as I can tell. The book's selling well, and, you know, I think they must be really happy. No, that's so cheesy. I really don't know. I mean, because I'm not there when they're reading it.
Do you not seek out feedback? Like, is it something you sort of shy away from, or do you like to hear what people think?
Well, I don't want to hear anything bad, you know. That'll just, you know, then I won't. No, I mean, I don't know. I don't know really where to seek it out.
Yeah. So when you're writing, when you're writing poetry, then how do you gauge whether or not you like it? Is it just?
No, I guess I shouldn't say. The book's done, so there's nothing I can do about it. But no, feedback's really important. I work with some really talented people in a writer's group. Yeah. So every week we take turns. So I've been doing that and working with some editors for years, some of the same people, as far as, you know, to get some constructive criticism. They're going to tell me the truth. They're not going to tell me if they like it or it's good.
Right. What kind of feedback is valuable to a poet?
Just something real honest. If it's working, tell me what you like about it. If it's not working, tell me why it's not working, and just real specifics, because I need to know, you know, what I'm writing this for. I'm writing it for the guy in the back of the crowd that got dragged to some poetry reading, you know, and isn't really sure why he's there. That's the kind of person I'm writing stuff for. I want to touch that audience and then everybody else too. And I love making people laugh, so, you know, that helps. But just real honest constructive criticism. You have to grow a thick skin really early on if you want to be a writer, I think.
Why is the guy in the back of the poetry reading who kind of got drugged there appealing to you? What is it about sort of reaching him?
I'm just really interested in conversations and good storytellers. And I think you need to be aware of all your audiences. And so I guess that's a little bit of a challenge to me as a writer. Like, I want to connect to that person. And I don't know, it's still a little surreal. You know, here we are, I'm on the radio. It's poetry month, I'm talking about poetry. If somebody would have told me, you know, 15 years ago I'd be doing this, I would have looked at him really funny. It's still, you know, if somebody says, oh, here's Jim Reese, he's a poet, it seems odd to me.
Yeah. You know, when did you first start calling yourself a poet?
I've never called myself a poet. I mean, I like writing, and I write all kinds of different things. I just publish more books in that genre, and I really like nonfiction. You know, I love what you're doing here on the radio. I love journalism. And just, you know, going back to what we had talked about earlier, which is good storytelling, you know.
I love your essays. Your essays, are they collected anywhere?
Yeah, and that's something I'm working on right now, is just getting those all. I mean, a lot of them have been published, so yeah, I need to just make the next move. Speaking of revisions, that's what I'm doing with those, just going through each one of them again. They've all appeared in magazines and different things, and going through them. You know, because some of them are 5 to 10 years old, so I know my voice has changed. A lot of some of my beliefs have changed. How has that voice changed in those essays a little bit, or what can I add to them to make them better?
Tell me something, because I noticed that as a writer myself. I'll do something, and I'll come back to it later, and I'll say, well, I've changed my mind about that. What's something that you've sort of changed your mind or honed your voice on over the past decade?
Oh, I'm always changing my mind about things. I mean, I think, I don't know what writer said that, or what writer said, you know, your book's never done, you just have to kind of stop. I mean, I can look at all of these books of mine here and find fault in them. Why did I break that line there? Why did I do this? Why didn't I add this? And so there's that always that constant revision of your own work, and you know your own work more than anybody else does. I think in the last 10 years, I've really realized how powerful humor can be. And then mixing that, though, telling your story and telling it honestly. And then, you know, I mean, I want an honest story. I also want to laugh. So I want to have both of those elements together if I can in poetry or essays or anything else.
One of the things I think you do as a poet is you see somebody exactly as they are in the grocery store, in the gas station, in any place that you might normally be. You describe them and you let me laugh about that, but not at them. How do you sort of bring these characters that you meet onto the page and give people something to smile at, but yet not mockingly?
Well, I think you just have to, I mean, if somebody followed me around all day long and wrote poems about what I was doing, it would be really funny because I just do really dumb things sometimes. So I think you have to realize that as a writer, you try not to be pretentious. You have to realize, hey, I'm human. I make mistakes all the time. And I've got to be able to make fun of myself, which then becomes fun. I mean, to then look at the world that way to realize, oh, you know what? I'm not any better than anybody else. It was the funniest thing after being actually getting a PhD and becoming a professor. You know, students that sometimes will look at you and go, well, you don't know? And I'm like, no, I have no idea. You know so much more about some things than I do. You know, I don't. That's just the way it is, you know, so I don't have all the answers. And humor's always saved me, and just being honest, you know, the truth is gonna trump fiction any day of the week, you know.
There's a kindness in your humor, and I would say that there's a self-depreciation too. You're just as quick to write a poem there. We sort of see you doing something that you're laughing at than someone else. Do you think there's a kindness in your poetry?
I hope so.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't ever want to be just making fun of somebody. I don't think that's very productive.
I don't think you go there. Yeah, I don't think you ever go to that.
You know, we talked about poems to read and stuff, but I have to ask myself as a writer all the time, too, why am I writing this, you know, besides just for a laugh, what does this mean? You know, I could tell you that I have these great poems about my mother-in-law, and then people laugh.
Right.
And I'm like, well, why are you laughing, though? I mean, why is that?
Because
I've
read some of those poems.
but then again, I have to ask myself, like, why, you know, she's such an amazing woman to me. Just what she does and her characteristics and, you know, how she saves everything and she's always got stuff. Let me read this one.
Yeah, please.
This is called The Keeper of All Things Whole and Necessary. Puts leftover food in little plastic baby food containers and yogurt cups she has hoarded. Will leave half a chicken wing for someone else to eat. Wraps up and refrigerates one slice of bacon. Puts lemon juice on half an apple so it won't turn brown. She washes and pack rats straws with holes and plastic silverware with broken tines. She has a drawer full of mustard, barbecue, and soy sauce packages from takeout restaurants from out of town. Has personalized greeting cards that she will white out and reuse. She cuts coupons, cuts and collects newspaper articles if she knows someone in the article or knows someone who knows the person in the article. She gives me play-by-plays of garage sales and auctions. Saves fresh scraps for stray cats and bones for the dogs. Saves for Jesus and saves for you. Picks green tomatoes before the first winter freeze, wraps them in tissue paper, and serves them for Thanksgiving dinner. Balances soap dispensers upside down like others do with ketchup bottles and eventually combines them in one. She has a room full of old jeans in case her husband's overalls need patching or her son-in-law's crotch blows out. She makes pie crust from hog lard, has full canning jars from the 80s and unidentifiable things older than dirt in her deep freeze. Once, I saw her pull a tarp for a pickup bed out from underneath her dresser. I've been holding on to this I don't know how long. If you need something, a blowtorch, nunchucks, twist ties, propane, a chandelier, goat cheese, a curtain rod, a basin wrench, bell bottoms, a bowling ball, anything, she's your woman.
What does she think of that poem?
She likes it. I mean,
it's a portrait. It's you see her.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. When you read that, you know that this is a woman that's been seen.
And I think you have to be honest, too, because I've had conversations with her about other poems that are in this new book where I said, you know, I have to remind you of something I wrote. The world's going to see it. Are you okay with this? And she said, and we were talking on the phone that day, and she said, you know, if I didn't do certain things, you wouldn't have anything to write about. And I thought that was pretty good, you know, and that was true. And a lot of, you know, I think I could put together a small collection of poems all about her and different things that have happened and things I wrote about. You know, one time she pulled some cherries out of a deep freeze from, and she has multiple deep freezes from like 1972, and she made a pie out of it.
Yeah.
And we ate it, and it was good.
Did she live through very hard times? Is this a result of?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. Tough times, just like a lot of people went through tough times. I don't.
But sometimes
she's just she. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you see strangers with an equal amount of affection that you see your family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You like people.
I do, and I. You know, I was going to say that. Because I love what you're doing on the radio here, and I think, you know, since you've started here, you're doing such a great service to literature, and to the writers in the area, and it's just neat to see. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but I'm right on that verge of being middle age, you know, and I'm not officially yet, but, I have noticed people that are, you know, that I used to look up to and respect and hang out with maybe even 10 years ago, and I just don't as much anymore because they're so interested in just some, not everybody, but some people are just interested in some superficial stuff, what they have in front of them and maybe their own little island. And I'm really interested in the bigger picture, you know, chipping out that iceberg, hoping that we can make a difference. You know, I want to believe that I'm here for a reason besides just writing poems, and doing that work at the prison, teaching those guys to write and things like that has been just amazing. But also just being a good writer. I talked to you about this once. I thought when I first met Charles Bowden was at the book festival in Deadwood, and this is back in 2012, and I asked him for his autograph. He wrote his name down, and we got to know each other, and he wrote on this casino voucher, he said, appetite is the road to life and culture. And I think you need that as a writer. I think you need to be hungry if you want to be a good writer, you know, and you have to have an interest in people, and you have to have an interest in doing something, I think, positive, you know, making a difference.
How do you keep that appetite as a writer? Does it just come naturally to you? Because I know every day I come to work, I'm interested in the conversation, and it just comes very naturally. Does it just sort of happen for you? You just care? Or do you do things specifically to feed that curiosity every day?
I don't know. I mean, I read as much as I can, you know, but I hope it comes naturally. That's just the way I've always been. You know, I don't like sitting around and watching TV. You know, I've never been like that. I've just always got to be doing something. You know, and as you get older, I think I heard this recently. Somebody said, Mark Twain said, the two most important days in your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. Hmm. So I think that's pretty cool. You know, he wrote a lot of great things and said a lot of great things. And I'm glad that was brought to my attention because I really feel like what I'm doing, in the prison especially, and what I've been called, maybe that's what I'm called to do, you know? And I think also we talk about humor and just being human too, you know? I think also that, you know, I've made some mistakes in my life. You know, I wish I could take them back, but I can't. And there's a lot of guys at the prison that are in that same boat. You know, we've all made mistakes. So I think you've got to be able to bring in that empathy. You've got to be humble. you've got to understand that you know better than anybody else. I think all those elements play into just good writing. I mean, I love David Sedaris. Why is David Sedaris so popular? You know, why do all of my students who've never bought a book in their life like his stuff? You know, because he's just honest, and he can make fun of himself. He can, you know, it's just, that's just the way it is, you know, but he tells a good story, and sometimes they're really tragic stories.
We'll have more good stories with author Jim Reese after the break. You're listening to Dakota Midday, South Dakota Public Radio. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with author and poet and professor Jim Reese. His book, Really Happy, is our Dakota Midday Book Club selection for April. Let's talk about your work in the prison. And tell me what, how long you've been doing it. It's been a while now.
This is my ninth year at Federal Prison Camp Yankton. So yeah, and each year we publish a book. Basically what happens is I get guys come into a class for a year, and by the end of the year we publish a book, which is free to the public. We don't sell them, so mm-hmm. we give them away for educational purposes. The main goal is, it's proven to work, you know, through writing and telling stories, it helps men come to terms with the emotional instabilities that brought them to prison. I think you could lock somebody up and teach them a trade, and that's fine and good, you know, that's great. But what you also have to do is help them tap into those emotional instabilities. Why are they there? Why did they, you know? And once they come to terms with that, that helps them. And through writing, that telling their stories, that really helps them kind of look at the bigger picture, I think.
Do you think some of them could have avoided whatever got them sent to prison if they had dealt with emotional instability earlier in their lives? Is that a possibility in your mind?
Sure. I think anybody could. Yeah. You know?
Are these people who notice things? You know, when you start working with people in the federal prison, as a general rule, are they good at being observant?
Well, I think in the class, they are in prison, so they're happy to be doing something different, I think, by coming to class, and they'll be so.
But I mean, in college, you've talked about having to teach your college students to notice things,
yeah,
to pay attention to five things and write them down, and some of them struggle with mm-hmm. that. Do you do the same approach?
Yeah, because at the prison we do the same exercise, and that's just something I learned from Ted Kooser. It's a really cool thing to do as a writer or as a person. Just, you know, think about it for a second. What are five things you've noticed in the last 2 hours?
Yeah.
You know, or in the last hour that you really paid attention to. And then you start asking yourself, maybe why am I paying attention to this stuff?
Are prisoners good at that? Are they natural at that?
I think just like anybody else, if they're curious, they want to, you know. I think everybody wants me to say sometimes, you know, oh, teaching there, it's so different, or I'm scared and things like that. And I was intimidated and scared maybe, you know, when I first started. And there was that curiosity factor. I'm going into an environment that we only see on TV, you mm-hmm. know. But the reality is, hey, look, you know, I'm no different from these guys. I've made mistakes. I had my first education, the first director of education there, supervisor of education that I had, said, hey, you know, any of us could have wound up here after a few misdirected decisions. And just always keep that in mind, you know, and I have, and I don't treat them any differently than I would treat any other student.
Do you think they were more intimidated by you with your PhD and your poetry lessons?
No, I hope not. You know, who knows? You know,
they haven't admitted to it.
I don't think so. Those are, you know, I'm in the room just like any, it's amazing. It doesn't matter if it's a classroom at Mount Marty College, a classroom at Federal Prison Camp Yankton, anywhere, you know. I love teaching because I'm always learning. Mm-hmm. I always learn something from my students. That's why I love being a teacher.
What have you learned from these men?
Empathy. Mm. You know, understanding. I learned how to be a better teacher.
How so? How did working with them help you be a better teacher?
Just by really listening too. Yeah. I think when you first start teaching, you know, I'm still guilty of it. I'll just want to talk and talk and talk because I either plan something out and have way too much material. And these guys, you know, go in there and give them an assignment, and they do it, and they start talking about it, and they just want to be heard. Mm. And when you really start listening to them, I mean, just some amazing stories unfold. And that's just, and that goes for all classes, though, too, I think. You know, I think to be an effective teacher or professor, you've got to know when to be quiet.
How has it changed you as a writer, as a poet?
Well, it's just, again, go back to the empathy and understanding that we're all, you know, make mistakes. And everybody, you know, I've said this before, and I always like to, you know, articulate it as much as I can. But, you know, I believe all people want to do the right thing, you know, to live healthy, productive lives, to give to their communities, even if they failed before. All of us make misdirected decisions in our lives, but that shouldn't restrict anybody from the right to an education or a right to a second chance.
Hmm. Does poetry offer a second chance?
Maybe writing does. It's a way of reflecting. Hmm. and really thinking about stuff, and then you have to write it down. And then you hope that you revise it, you know, 20 to 40 times, and then and then maybe that's a second chance, and you can show it to somebody and say, hey, I thought about this, and I was able to write about it, and hopefully it makes some sense to everybody.
Do you have a poem you want to share that sort of relates to your work in the prison? Or
sure. And so one of the things I do all the time, too, is we always workshop our stuff in all my classes, wherever I'm at. So I'll bring in new work, and I just, and working there, some of these guys are my age, so we get a chance to really, they give me some honest feedback. They're not going to sugarcoat anything. This is called This Isn't Dress Rehearsal. It's 53 degrees this afternoon. Tomorrow time will spring ahead. In 5 minutes, the still obnoxiously loud grade school bell will alarm the neighborhood. In line at the chain link fence with some other fathers who have shown up, I'm waiting for you, my daughters. Today, recess should never end. In 2 months, one of you will leave this place for middle school, the other ascend to second grade. Some things never change. I claw my hands into the chain link that seems so much shorter now. I see the tire swing, the basketball hoop without a net, black top and worn tetherball. I'm not old enough to wish I were back in your shoes, not with the math homework you're assigned. But there's an aching for some of that freedom. Maybe that's why none of the fathers standing here say a word. And when I shared the rough draft of this poem in class, a prisoner said, "That's one fence I never minded being behind." Girls, do you know how much I'm going to miss these days, this magical moment on all of our faces when we see each other between these boundaries waiting to go home?
Thank you for that. You wrote a poem once, and I don't remember what it was called or where it was, but it was the first poem I had read by you where you referenced your daughters, and she's falling, and you catch her seconds before her head hits the concrete. And that poem just got to me and stuck with me for such a long time, that moment of a dad just reaching out and grabbing his child. Do your kids, they've grown up with poetry?
A little bit.
How do they respond to it?
I think they like it. They love, you know, we have tons of books at home, so. Mm. And they all have, my oldest daughter now is 12 and a half. No, not quite 12 and a half, but she might say that. And she's reading a series of different books right now. And, you know, just the excitement of last night of, you know, a box on the table with more books in it. And we have a lot, you know. So they like it. And I just wrote a poem about her, and it was pretty cool because she said to my wife, she said, "Hey, Dad wrote this cool poem about me." It's just a poem about her. She's in dance. She's in a lot of dance classes. So it's a poem about her standing in line, and she'll just start spinning, you know, and doing these different ballet moves. And I'm just so used to it that I don't think anything of it, you know. It's just what she does. One time we were in line, and the lady who was working, she said, "Excuse me, young lady, but there can't be any dancing in line." And so I wrote something about that day, right. So it was she liked that one at least. So,
did you just say, "Ma'am, I'm a poet"? Really, that's just thank you for that. There's no dancing in line.
But
I'm gonna take that.
Yeah, and then as a writer, that's what you do, right? You start. Somebody says something like that, you're like, okay, well, we'll work with that later.
Your children have given you so much.
Yeah,
as a writer, they really have. Is it hard for you to be that honest on the page about your love for them, or is that an easier thing to access?
It's pretty hard just talking about it more right now, really, like every once in a while, there'd be that box of photos your parents would drag out and they're like, "Oh, I remember this time," and you'd start looking at it, and that's really cool. I mean, and I think, wow, could you imagine, having your folks say, "Oh, here's something I wrote about you." Hmm. So that's pretty cool. I hope that they feel that way, 10, 20 years from now. But,
it goes back to being seen. Yeah. You saw them and then you took the time to write about it.
Yeah, and there's only a few times now where I'm catching myself where I have to be careful and say, okay, yeah, I can't write about that. I'll probably upset them.
But you can write about it. You can't publish it, maybe.
Yeah.
Give it to them later.
But I don't want to embarrass them, or anything like that. So, yeah, there's lots of things, and it's just that's one of those universal things as a writer, too, that I think will relate to that guy in the back of the audience, maybe, or whoever. It's what am I going to write about and why am I writing about this?
Do you need to have a reason?
I don't know. Yeah, I think so. Hmm. Yeah. But also, but you kind of know, sometimes you can just see something and as a poet, I can look, something will happen. I'm like, oh yeah, we'll be writing about that later.
Yeah.
And I'm saying we like the multiple voices in my head, but you said that earlier. Yeah. Oh, so yeah, you're thinking the lady in line that says not to dance. And, okay, well, yeah. And you can always, as a writer too, you get the last word sometimes, don't you?
Yeah. And if you don't want that to be the last word, you can go online. We've got bonus audio of my extended conversation with Jim Reese. We talk about why a writer needs discipline. Jim reads more poetry, and together we make our share of mistakes and talk about the power of imperfection. It's online after the program today, sdpb.org/DakotaMidday.